Welcome to the Birth Lounge Podcast, an empowering space for expecting and new parents to hear candid conversations with experts, support your mental health, and learn the tips and tricks that thousands of parents have used to craft their ideal birth. We will answer all of your questions, the scary ones and the weird ones, to help calm your fears and feel confident going into your birth. I'm going to help you redefine what birth and motherhood looks like and how to embrace your journey. I've intentionally crafted an amazing list of experts to help you navigate pregnancy, explore your birth options, and plan for postpartum so it can be a time of soaking in your tiny human. We're going to go there on all the hard topics so that you can dive into finding your confidence and freeing yourself from fears around childbirth. With almost 10 years of experience in family education and a master's degree in human development and family studies, I created this podcast as a way to share information so parents can make educated and informed decisions about their care during pregnancy and childbirth. This is a birth community driven by evidence-based information and research in hopes to help you explore your options, understand your rights, and know what choices you have along the way. I'm your host, Hee-Hee. Now let's get to the good stuff. Hey guys, there's another chance for us to hang out on April 9th at 8 p.m. Eastern time. I am going to host a live call that is going to be talking about how you can reduce your risk of C-section and reduce your risk of tearing in labor. I'm going to be sharing the top three reasons for cesareans in the U.S., how you can find out about your hospital and your provider's stats when it comes to their C-section rate and induction rate, the benefits of laboring at home, plus all of the information that you need to know in order to advocate for yourself in labor. Also, don't forget, I'm going to be talking about decreasing your risk for tearing. So we are going to be talking about the most effective pushing positions and the importance of perineal massage. And at the end of the call, I will stick around for a Q&A to answer all of your questions. So be sure to grab the link for that. We'll meet on Zoom. You can head to the show notes to save your seat. Bye. Hey, y'all, and welcome back to another episode of the Birth Lounge Podcast. All right, you guys, we are three episodes deep in C-section prevention month here on the podcast. If you didn't know and you haven't listened to episode 254, my interview with Dr. Neil Shaw, and 255, it's a fun little what would you rather episode where I asked our audience on our social medias to submit questions of would you rather, and that's what I did last episode, and it was super fun to see your questions and also to like think about what I would rather do. All right, it is C-section awareness month kind of nationally, but I, instead of bringing awareness to C-sections, which I feel like we all have already, I would like to help do C-section prevention. I want to help you prevent an unnecessary C-section. I want you to understand what are the things that lead to C-sections, what are evidence-based reasons where we need a C-section, where it would be appropriate, what are a lot of the common reasons where we see C-sections be inappropriately diagnosed or used, or places where in labor we commonly see this choice be made where we could easily make this choice and it would reduce your chances of a C-section. There's a lot of ways that we can actually mitigate that risk so you don't end up as that one out of three people that go in and come out having a major abdominal surgery. Preventing unnecessary C-sections is something I'm so passionate about because I think it is so easy to do. If we stop over-medicalizing birth, we stop inducing people unnecessarily, and we truly have a curriculum. There are things and rules, almost guidelines, that doctors can use to determine if someone is appropriate for a C-section or if there are other things that we can do. The, you know, place where we go wrong is that a lot of times those guidelines, those rules, that criteria is never visited and or it's not applied correctly. Something that comes to my mind is failure to progress. Literally 48 hours ago, I sat in a room teaching childbirth education and someone raised their hand and said, I didn't know anything,
going in to my first birth, and I had what I now consider an unnecessary C-section, and I felt like on my birth, or in my birth, at my birth experience, I was just like being told what to do. I was just doing what they were saying to do. I wasn't really empowered to make decisions. I wasn't actually really in the conversation, so it didn't feel like I had a place to be a decision maker. And you know, that breaks my heart. And so this time, that mom is going for a VBAC. And so we talked in depth about what that looks like, what that process is going to be like, what she should expect, and also how your prep for a VBAC is going to be different. And I want to avoid that for you. I want you to get on the other side of your first birth and say, holy shit, I am powerful. I did that. I was meant to do this. I also want to hold space for that small part of the population that is high risk, right? And your body maybe does struggle a little bit harder to keep and hold and grow and birth a pregnancy. I am in no way forgetting those people or shaming those people. Unfortunately, that's just statistics. There will always be a part of the population that's high risk. And in that case, those people do need higher trained medical professionals, right? So a lot of times you are seeing an OBGYN over a midwife. You may have an MFM on your team where someone who's low risk is able to see a midwife, maybe even birth at home, does not have an OBGYN or a MFM on their case. Things change when you are high risk. But if you're a low risk birther, there are so many things that we can do to help you avoid an unnecessary C-section and reduce your risk for having a necessary C-section. So, a good place that I thought I would start is a question that I get so often. And that is, how do I reduce my risk of a C-section? You know, I hear it all the time. I'll say, you know, what are your goals for birth? And instead of telling me what you want, a lot of people will say, well, I don't want a C-section. I'm trying to not have a C-section unless it is medically necessary. And of course, I'll do whatever's best for me and my baby. Like, duh, that's a given. But they always say, like, I'll do whatever if my baby needs it. If it's medically necessary, I, of course, will have a C-section. But I really don't want a C-section. So that is my plan.
With that, I think it's really important that we, you know, take some time to think about the current stats that we have in America right now. 1 in 3 women are coming out of their birth experience with a C-section. 1 in 3 women are also being induced. And a lot of those, to be completely honest, are not medically necessary. A lot of them are elective. Not that there's anything wrong with elective induction, but many people either don't know their options, so they don't know that they can choose something different. And then many times people feel like they actually can't say no, that it's not an option, that their doctors said this is what they were going to do, or their doctor just put induction date on the calendar and they didn't feel like they had, you know, the right to say no thank you, or I'm not going to come, or whatever it may be. But you do. So if you're listening out there and that's you, you're in that situation where you have found yourself, you know, your doctor, you are in maybe disagreement on how you're going to continue your pregnancy. They want you to be induced at 39 weeks based on the ARRIVE trial, and you really want to stay pregnant and wait for spontaneous labor. Or maybe you were checking your online portal. This literally happened to a client of ours last week. Check in your online portal and you just see an induction date on there. It hasn't been discussed with you. You've not even talked about at all induction, and you see that that is on the calendar for you. You know, you have the right to say, I hear you and I understand your recommendation, your clinical suggestion, but right now I'm choosing to decline the elective induction. And if it becomes medically necessary, you know, I'm always open to have this conversation again and we can pivot at that point. But until then, as long as it remains elective and waiting for spontaneous labor is a safe option, that's what I want to do. You know, another very interesting stat is that more than 50% of people say that losing control in labor is their biggest fear. And when I came across that stat, I actually thought it was super interesting because, you know, fear is a funny thing. Fear, especially the fear around birth, is basically all because of the unknown. And things in the birth world are only unknown because there's a lot of gatekeeping. So I'm going to try and open those gates. That's exactly what I do with this podcast and inside the Birth Lounge and on my social media accounts. I try and give you access to the information that otherwise may not be very readily available. And, you know, with that, I will say that everything has its place in labor. And I want you to be able to spot the things that are no longer evidence-based. And I want you to be able to advocate for your goals. And I want you to understand why you are either requesting or declining whatever it is that you are asking for or saying no to. My goal is to help you go into labor feeling really informed about your rights and your options. I want you to feel in control during that entire process. And that includes pregnancy, labor, the end of pregnancy, right after your baby, during your postpartum stay, at your 6-week visit. I mean, everything in your feeding journey, making decisions about your child and their sleep and their development. I also want you to be able to confidently navigate the hospital system and stay in control of the decisions that are made during your labor process. Because when I talk to people who, you know, have birth trauma or experience some inappropriate things in labor or were just downright subjected to abuse during their birth experience, it always comes back to, I didn't feel like I was being able to make autonomous decisions for myself. Someone along the way had stripped them of that control. And so that's what I want you to walk away with. I want you to know that you can advocate for your goals and really have a good foundation under your feet to help you make those decisions where you are confident, not because, you know, you are just so married to one idea, but you're confident because you know the options, you know what the data says, you know the risk and the benefits, and you know what you're comfortable risking, and you know what benefits are worth it to you. And actually, what I'm sharing is all from a live call that I taught inside the Birth Lounge. I go live and teach for our members so that they can have constantly updated information and they can ask their questions and they can have this really high touch experience childbirth education. And this is from that. So, all right, let's talk about how do we actually reduce your risk of having a C-section and hopefully avoid it altogether for you. So number one, and I do not think this is going to be a surprise to anybody, but it is waiting for spontaneous labor. The debacle out there surrounding the 39-week elective induction in order to reduce your risk of a C-section, in my mind, is a total crock, and I feel like providers a lot of times use it in manipulation of patients to get them to induce early. So here's the thing about the ARRIVE trial. It is highly flawed because one of the biggest things that it left out was having a standard induction protocol, which means everybody in the study was induced using different methods and, you know, using different protocols. So that's really hard to then take out in the real world and apply it to every person that is having a baby. So for me, that really kind of makes the study null and void. Another thing is they do try and conclude, or I guess with this flawed data, they do conclude that you have a lower chance of having a C-section if you agree to this 39-week induction. However, it is so negligible. It's literally like 3 to 5% of a reduction. But when we look at actually inducing early, especially on a cervix that is not ripe, so that means your cervix is not ready
for an induction, it is likely not going to be super receptive. You know, we determined this by Bishop score. I have a whole entire module in the Birth Lounge all about induction, and I also have a bunch of free resources on my social media, so check those out. I'm not going to go into the induction here, but what I will say is before you agree to that 39-week induction because your provider has told you it'll reduce your risk for a C-section, you should actually truly look into that, because the way that the ARRIVE trial presents that information is quite sneaky deaky, and I just want you to be aware of that. Okay, so now that we've established that, with spontaneous labor, you definitely decrease your risk of having a C-section, and here's why. When your body is meant to do something, unless it asks for your help, we can just trust that your body knows what it's doing. It's literally designed to birth your baby. Now, there are cases, obviously, where we need to step in. Someone who develops high blood pressure or hypertension or cholestasis. There are a million things that may pop up in the end of labor or the end of pregnancy that will require you to consider a medical induction. So if you're high risk or something pops up that then needs medical attention, yes, an induction, but for the people who don't have that, spontaneous labor is definitely better. Why intervene when we don't need to, you know? So there are a couple of theories of what actually starts labor, and one of them is the hormonal cocktail of estrogen and oxytocin. Now, estrogen and oxytocin naturally both rise during pregnancy, and that oxytocin is partially responsible for contractions, obviously. And the people who believe this theory believe that once these hormones, this oxytocin and estrogen, have reached a certain level, then labor contractions will start and you'll be kind of on your way into labor. The second theory is your baby's lungs. Now, this is the theory that I tend to gravitate towards, but I have to be honest, I actually think it could be a combination of all of the theories, and that each individual researcher has just found one piece of the puzzle. I believe the human body is very complex. But the baby's lung theory says that when your baby is fully mature, they will release a substance that will then mix with your amniotic fluid that will trigger your body to release prostaglandins, which will then kick you into labor. Now, we know our old friend prostaglandin, yes, from labor, but also from periods. Yeah, from our menstrual cycle. Prostaglandins are responsible for the cramping and also the period poops. It is like a hormone-like substance that it just triggers everything to be released. It triggers that cramping. Prostaglandins are also responsible for the effacement, so the thinning out of your cervix in labor, which is why when you need an induction, if you do not have a favorable cervix, meaning your cervix is not very thin and maybe a little dilated, we'll start with prostaglandins. Cytotec, Cervidil, Misoprostol, there's a couple of different things. A non-pharmaceutical option would be a balloon, but obviously that's not prostaglandin. So you can see how prostaglandins are very important in this process. And so if those prostaglandins are waiting for that substance to be released from your baby's lungs, this would make sense. Okay, so the final theory, and just to be clear, these aren't like the only theories out there, but these are the most popular ones, I think. These are the ones that I hear the most when people start to kind of think about the start of labor. I almost want to say debate, because it typically turns into a debate of sorts. But anyway, okay, theory number three. Cortisol. And not yours, but yours will hold up the labor process. So if you are really stressed out and you are, you know, not keeping your brain distracted and you're not working on your mindset and you're not reminding yourself that your baby and your body know what to do and you're not relaxing, your cortisol levels are going to spike, and, you know, that will absolutely prevent you from going into labor. But this theory is about your baby's cortisol, and it's believed by some people, and there's actually some pretty good evidence to back this up, that your baby's adrenals will release cortisol once they're fully developed, and that will kick you in to labor. So pretty cool theories. And you know, while we may not be able to agree on exactly what starts labor, I think one thing is abundantly clear, and that is that your baby and your body will do this process. They know what they're doing if they're given the time and the space. So waiting on that spontaneous labor, waiting on your baby to kick off labor, can be so, so beneficial. All right, there's one study that I shared that I think is so fascinating, and I think that it is such a pillar in this conversation because it was such a large study. All right, so in Sweden, they conducted a 14-year study that had more than 1 million births in it, and they found that induction was associated with an increased risk of both C-section and vacuum extraction, even in women without documented medical complications. I mean, I don't really know how much more clear it could get from there. And then when you think about that in comparison to the ARRIVE trial had just a little over 6,000 participants in it. So I don't know. You know, ACOG 2 does recognize the risk of induction, even if your provider doesn't necessarily go over those with you. So the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology has a couple of resources in regards to induction, and we'll link everything for you in the show notes. But in these resources, under the risk, they do mention the following: the uterus may be overstimulated, that you may develop an infection of the amniotic fluid called chorioamnionitis. Your baby might experience an infection. You might have rupture of the uterus, which is called uterine rupture. Other risks may include funky fetal heart tones, contractions that are too strong, and that labor induction may not even work. And just like in the Sweden study, they also mentioned that you may have a need for assisted vaginal delivery or a C-section. You know, one other thing that I think we have to talk about is that your due date is a guess, and it's an estimate as well. And when we look at human development, we know that there's a spectrum. Some babies are not going to need as long, and some babies are going to need a little bit longer. We also know that only 3 to 5% of babies are actually born on their due date. So there is a 95 to 97% chance that your baby is not going to come on your quote-unquote due date. I encourage you to think about it more like a whole due window. Your baby could come anywhere from 37 to 42 weeks. And ACOG actually does have these weeks defined. So early term is 37 and 38 weeks. 39 and 40 are full term. 41 is late term, and anything past 42 weeks is what they call post-term. Now, when we look into what causes a post-term baby, ACOG says they have 4 criteria, and it is, number 1, this is your first baby. So that tells me everything I need to know. That tells you everything right there. Number 2 is you're carrying a male fetus. Number 3 is you have had a prior post-term pregnancy. And number 4, you are obese. And one thing I found interesting is when I was looking into post-term pregnancy as defined by ACOG, they do have a sentence on there that says most women who give birth after their due dates have uncomplicated labor and give birth to healthy babies. They do then go on to define the risks that are associated to post-term pregnancy. So if you're thinking about going beyond that 42-week mark, make sure that you understand what the risks are and just make sure you're comfortable taking on those risks, and how long are you comfortable continuing your pregnancy. Now, when you are searching about postterm pregnancies, the internet can get really scary about the whole idea of a big baby, or what we call fetal macrosomia. So what does ACOG say about this? Well, they say that fetal macrosomia is not an indication for delivery and rarely is an indication for C-section. So the babies that they do recommend it being a C-section for are for people who do not have diabetes, an 11-pound baby or 5,000 grams, and for people who do have gestational diabetes, 4,500 grams, which is about 9.9 pounds. So we're talking about some really big babies here. They also do say that ultrasonography for estimated fetal weight in the third trimester should be used sparingly and with clear indications, because we all know that not only is ultrasound very inaccurate in being able to predict fetal weight, but the bigger the baby, the more inaccurate it is. So if you're getting an ultrasound and someone is saying you've got a big baby in there, we suggest inducing or having a C-section, you've got some questions to ask, right? How big is my baby? Do I have gestational diabetes? You know, you have to consider this. How are we diagnosing this if it's ultrasound? How accurate is that? A lot of questions to be asked may not be the right choice for you. And along the same lines with a big baby, we always hear about shoulder dystocia when big babies come up. So I wanted to look into if there was any data supporting the idea that we might be able to reduce the risk of shoulder dystocia with induction or by offering scheduled C-sections. And this is what ACOG says. At this time, and until additional studies are reported, suspected macrosomia or LGA fetus, large for gestational age, is not an indication for induction of labor before 39 weeks because there is insufficient evidence that benefits of reducing shoulder dystocia risk would outweigh the harms of delivery. And in terms of infant mortality and risk of major complications, they do note that the risk increases sharply for babies after 4,500 grams, or that 9.9 pounds. So what are the risks that you have a baby this big? Well, they say that for people who have their babies between 39 and 40 weeks gestation, the risk of having a baby weigh more than 4,500 grams or 9.9 pounds is about 1.3. But for people who exceed that 41st week in gestation, the risk goes up to 2.9. Now, that 1.3 to 2.9 is a statistic that you can see that it more than doubles, and those words feel really scary. But when you zoom out a little bit and you realize that the risk overall is still less than 3%, so you have more than a 97% chance that your baby is not over that 9.9 pound mark, it feels a little better. Statistics can easily be manipulated in the way that they are presented to you. So just be careful with that and make sure that you understand the real numbers so that you can spot any sort of coercive care that you may encounter. All right, so I think that pretty much wraps up point number one, which is avoid an induction if you can. Give your body and your baby the time and the space to initiate this labor process on its own, unless, you know, you have a medical reason to intervene. Unless your body or your baby is asking for some help, you should let it do its thing. All right, so now that we are in spontaneous labor and we've given our body the time and the space, we're going to just remain home. Number two is labor at home as long as possible. The less time that you spend in the hospital, the less opportunity there is to have unnecessary interventions. Low-risk labors are safe to stay home until active labor or it becomes necessary to medically intervene. One of the biggest questions I get is, how am I going to know when to go to the hospital? And here's what I tell people. You will know, but what most people are not expecting is how long labor is. So you know that rule that says you should dilate 1 centimeter an hour? Well, that is based on what's called Friedman's curve, and it was designed in the 1950s, and it actually is only applicable from 4 centimeters on. And you know what else was really, really different in the 1950s? Their C-section rate. So back then, the C-section rate was only 2 to 6%. I think that a lot of people are really unprepared for how long labor is. In the 1950s, it wasn't really common for people to have epidurals either, so that also probably contributed to their really low C-section rate. Now, remember how I just said that Friedman's curve is only applicable after 4 centimeters? In 2010, we actually got a new study that said it should be applicable from 6 centimeters on. And this study included 19 hospitals and more than 62,000 births. So I think it's, you know, safe to say that these results are definitely worth something. The final kind of result of this study says that labor may take over 6 hours to progress from 4 to 5 centimeters. So not 2 4 to 5 centimeters, but from 4 centimeters to 5 centimeters, this study found that it may take over 6 hours to make just that 1 centimeter. And then it says it may take over 3 hours to progress from 5 centimeters to 6 centimeters. So you can see how early labor from 0 to 6 is really, really long. You're talking about 60% of the labor, and in just 2 centimeters, you might spend 9+ hours just getting from 4 to 6, right? So if we've been setting ourselves up for, you know, 1 centimeter an hour plus 1 or 2 hours of pushing, you're looking at 10 hours of labor and 2 hours of pushing, 12 hours. And that is actually a very, very fast birth for a first-time mom. Most of our clients, first-timers, have 24 to 36-hour births. And it's actually not uncommon for 40 hours to pop in there. You know, when you have things like prodromal labor, or you get sweeps, and so it's kind of unclear when labor started versus when you were just kind of crampy from the sweeps. There's a lot of things that happen in labor in those beginning stages that can feel like maybe nothing is happening or that things are going super slow, but you have to understand that for your cervix to open up to actually do that dilation part, it has to be thin first. And we would hope that effacement would happen in the last kind of weeks and the days leading up to your labor, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you need a night or two of labor to get that effacement and start that dilation progress before you're in active labor. And then once you're in that active labor pattern, which is usually defined around 6 centimeters, then we find that people are progressing about 1 centimeter every 2 or 3 hours. Now, the study found that beyond that 6 centimeter mark, people with an epidural usually had 3.6 hours left in labor, and people without 2.8 hours. So you're roughly looking at anywhere from 2.5 to 4 hours later. And they conclude that allowing the labor to continue for longer periods before 6 centimeters of dilation may actually reduce the U.S.'s C-section rate. Of course, I looked up what ACOG says about this, and they actually do recommend delaying admission to the hospital for people who are in early labor and who remain low risk and your baby looks good. It's actually part of their approach to what they call approaches to limit intervention during labor and birth, found in Committee Opinion 766. Here's the thing about being home. You're just a little bit more comfortable, right? And the hospital environment really isn't meant to be grounding and calming. There's a lot of beeping and there's noises and there's people in the hallway and there's people in and out. And, you know, up until recently, maybe in your area, maybe not anymore in your area, people are wearing masks and, you know, there's all sorts of things going on. It's kind of distracting. And one thing that we know is in order for your body to relax and for your fight or flight to be able to be 100% shut off, you have to feel like you trust your team, like you are safe, like you can truly let your guard down. And if you don't feel that way, like truly feel that way, your body is going to automatically kick into fight or flight. And this is going to dramatically alter the process of labor and birth. You might see things like stalled labors. You might see things like your contractions go completely away. You might see things like your cervix actually kind of closes up a little bit. There's all sorts of ways that your body might respond, and very rarely is it positive, right? A lot of times we see it really disrupt the labor process when you're not feeling safe. And so staying home can provide you that environment that you are comfortable, you are safe, it is private, you can control the lighting and the noise and what you see and hear and feel, the people that are around you, the people in and out. You have total control over that at home. So as long as you're safe to do so, you really kind of should, right? By staying home, you really reduce your risk of germs and infection as well. So first, you're just not in the hospital, which is going to drastically reduce your, you know, risk of picking up anything. Second, the shorter amount of time that you're at the hospital, the less opportunity there is to give you cervical exams. And we know that with every cervical exam, the risk of getting an infection is kind of compounded. It builds on one another. There's also less chance for you to receive Pitocin, right? And if you're home and that fight or flight is not being tripped, there is a greater chance that your natural oxytocin is going to do what it needs to do. When you're comfortable and you feel safe, those surges of oxytocin can come as they need. But when you have, you know, lights staring at you and people in and out of your room and lots of kind of beeping that you're not sure if they're good noises or concerning noises, those things are going to produce cortisol in your brain, and that's going to stop your labor. It's also, you know, could stress your baby out. Cortisol is something that you kind of naturally have, but when it is big surges, that's definitely not ideal in labor. All right, I'm not going to go into how to know when to go in the hospital because that's something I teach inside the birth lounge. But what I will say is you've waited for spontaneous labor, you've labored at home, and now we are at the hospital. The final thing that you need to know about avoiding a C-section that I think nobody tells you. See, everybody tells you, keep moving, be upright, practice your breathing. What nobody tells you, and this is my number three, it's know the definition of failure to progress. So the definition is going to vary around the world, which leads to varying rates of failure to progress when we look at the data. But one thing we know for certain when we look at the data in the U.S. is that failure to progress leads to higher C-sections because so many people do not actually meet the criteria that are receiving this diagnosis. So there are three parts to being diagnosed with failure to progress. And the first two are what I find most people don't meet, yet they received this diagnosis and had a C-section. Our team does a lot of VBAC births, and so this is how I have so many stories of people who had unnecessarians their first time around. All right, so the definition, you've got three parts. Number one, Ruptured membranes. And this is something I talk about in all of the induction stuff in the Birth Lounge, is understanding what each induction method means and how it impacts things down the road. Because if you use rupture of membranes, now you have just checked that off and you can't leave again, right? So number one, ruptured membranes. Number two, you need to be at least 6 centimeters. So again, in that new updated since 2010 definition of active labor. And then the third piece is no cervical change. And it depends on whether you are on Pitocin or not on Pitocin, but that's going to be 4 to 6 hours with no cervical change. But you have to have all three. How many people do I meet that say, well, I had, you know, failure to progress. I, you know, my body like failed to dilate. I didn't get past 2 centimeters. So they gave me a C-section. Well, that didn't meet the criteria. You're supposed to be at least 6 centimeters, right? We just talked about how long it could take for the body to go from 4 to 6 hours, and all the work before that, hours. Labor is long. You know what breaks my heart? People who say, well, I labored for 16 hours and my baby wasn't here, so they gave me a C-section. Oh my goodness. 3 characteristics, you guys. Ruptured membranes, at least 6 centimeters, and then 4 to 6 hours of no cervical change, depending on whether you have Pitocin or not. Birth takes time, you guys, right? And instead of stacking on interventions, why don't we try the things that we know work? So get up, get moving. If you have an epidural, let's turn that sucker down. Not to a place where you're feeling discomfort again, but to a place where you have good feelings over your legs, but you also have adequate pain relief. There is a balance there. And if you are so numbed up, then not only is that brain-body connection totally disrupted and your body is not being able to communicate with the hormones in your brain to tell your body to keep going with labor, it's just like stunned from all the heavy narcotics we just put directly into your spine. Your baby, the same thing. And so what we want to do is make sure that A, the placement of the epidural is really good. B, that the dosage is correct. It's giving you that pain relief that you're going for, but you're not completely like dead, locked out, numb, right? And then third is we still have you up in kind of moving in different positions, getting your hips open and that pelvis mobile, allowing your baby to do those cardinal movements of that corkscrew downward motion that they do in labor, right? Get your oxytocin going, right? Do some clitoral stim, bring a vibrator with you, do some nipple stim, bring a hand pump with you, have your partner lay in the bed and cuddle with you, make out, go into the bathroom, shut the door, make it steamy. Get that oxytocin flow and watch your wedding video. You know how many wedding videos I've seen? Hundreds. I watch birth videos all the time in labor because it gets that love hormone going, right? It gets that oxytocin flowing. We need that. In order to do these things, though, it requires you to kind of understand how the human body works, which is what I teach you in the Birth Lounge. That's the foundation of it, is you can understand what the birth process is so that you know how to pivot and turn and twist and duck and bob and weave hospital policy and to navigate the hospital system and to always be advocating for your goals and to always be thinking ahead about the decisions that you're making and how will this impact things going forward, the pros and the cons and the risk and the benefits, right? And the Birth Lounge isn't geared towards any type of specific birth. I teach you about the entire birth process, the actual science and the hormones and how your body is actually going to experience and facilitate labor. And then I teach you how to achieve that unmedicated labor, or what you need to know about having an empowered C-section, or how can you reduce your risk of a C-section when you have an epidural, exactly what we've been talking about, right? How do you have a positive induction? How do you have a positive unwanted induction? What if you didn't want it and it's medically necessary, right? Failure to progress. You know, we already established what failure to progress is. So if you are stalled and debating whether or not to break your waters, don't forget that you have more than one option. You can go home if your waters aren't broken and try again. Also, you need to be GBS negative. So if you're GBS positive or you have signs of infection, you would need to stay as well once your waters are broken. But other than that, if your waters are intact, you can go home. I actually did a podcast all about what you need to know about inductions with midwife Becca Healy, and that's episode 146, if you want to scroll back and listen to that. But it's really good. You need to know that there are some situations where breaking your water is appropriate, and it will yield benefits, but sometimes, a lot of times, amniotomy is not recommended, right? And did you know that failure to progress is actually the number one reason for C-sections? The second is non-reassuring fetal heart tones. So just know that. And then third is actually malpresentation. So a baby that is in a super funky position, which I find that Pitocin impacts that a lot. And I teach you all about that too in the Birth Lounge. But yeah, what else do I need to tell you about failure to progress? Oh, you know what? Here's the thing. If you are not checking your cervix often, then it's really hard to progress to diagnose you with failure to progress, because we don't know if it's been 4 to 6 hours because we haven't had a cervical check in 8 hours. We're just letting your body do its thing, right? Also, know why you would be saying no to these cervical exams that you're declining. What will it change? Well, if the answer is nothing, then don't have it. Do we need this information to keep going in labor? Is it going to help us make a decision about pain relief? You know, if the answer is no, then you probably don't need it. There are people who go their entire labor without having a single cervical exam, and you know what? Their baby is born. Their baby is born. All right, the last thing I want to mention is a 2022 Cochrane review that looked at cervical checks in labor, and this is what they concluded. Slow labors can also be a normal variation of labor progress, and the recent evidence suggests that if mother and baby are well, length of labor or cervical dilation alone should not be used to decide whether labor is progressing normally or not. So there we go. I think that if you can really nail these three things, you have got such a good shot of avoiding unnecessary C-sections. Now, let's hold space for the fact that sometimes C-sections are needed. But a lot of times, especially in America, we're seeing so many unnecessarians. And the problem is not the C-section itself. The problem is the trauma that it is leaving people with. And that is my goal with the Birth Lounge, is to help you avoid unnecessary trauma. And it's not some woo-woo stuff that I'm teaching. I'm literally teaching you the data so that you can go in and have these educated discussions, so that when someone says, we're concerned because you haven't made, you know, progress in about 4 hours, we think that we need to do a C-section, you can say, that's weird, because that's not the definition of failure to progress, because I'm only 3 centimeters and I should be at least 6, and also my waters are intact, right? There's not going to be any mistaking or accidentally diagnosing you with something that you don't meet the criteria for, when you know what the criteria are and you can help have a really informed conversation with your provider about your wishes and your goals, and that, you know, you feel comfortable continuing to labor and your baby is well and you are well, and your goals are to just let your body do it and not intervene until absolutely necessary. It's important that you know why you are declining things so that you can have these conversations with your provider. Also, know the things that are really important to you. Know the things that you want to ask for your preferences, your boundaries, things like that. All right, you guys, this has been so much fun. I hope that you walked away with something that was super helpful. If you did, please head over to wherever you're listening to podcasts and leave me a review. And if you didn't like what you hear, just don't write that anywhere. That's perfect. You can keep that to yourself. Thanks so much. All right, you guys, thanks for tuning in with me. I am so excited for this new season. It is going to be so much fun. The guests are rad. The lineup is awesome. Our topics are off the charts, and we're really going to help you have a confident and informed birth. Oh, I'm so excited. See you next time.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I truly do value this community and I love hanging out with you. If you found today's episode helpful, share it with a friend. Share it with someone who might also find this information helpful. I'd love to hear what you have to say and read your sweet words on iTunes. You can leave us a review, and this helps get this information into the hands of parents who might also benefit from hearing it. If you're interested in joining the Birth Lounge, you can go to thebirthlounge.com. Our blog is linked there. You can find all sorts of free information as well as how to get your access to the Birth Lounge. You can always hang out with me on Instagram as well, at Tranquility by Hehe. Until then, stay educated, stay supported, stay confident.
Nothing in this podcast is to be used as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. As always, please consult your healthcare provider with any questions or concerns you have about your health or anything discussed in this podcast. Side effects may include educated adults, informed decision-making skills, and consensual care. Tranquility by Hehe and the Birth Lounge are not responsible for any ideal births that were created with this podcast. The birth parent deserves all the credit.